Dizette, and welcome to Shift F1, a podcast about speedy race cars. That's French for Mode 7, which, trust me, comes up later in the show. It's not just, we're not just talking about the Super Nintendo here. With me, Drew Scanlon, and Danny O'Dwyer. How are you, Danny?
I'm doing good. My high school French made me think that was Fashion 7, but we have Googled it, and it is also Mode 7. French is a complicated language.
Speaking of fashion, Rob Zachney, how are you?
Oh, yeah, feeling very fashionable in my here's what was still clean after vacation garb.
Now, nobody gets to see, like, because we do this over Skype video, no one gets to see Rob wearing his amazing repertoire of colorful pimp suits that he wears every single week.
Yeah.
I don't know why he does this, but it's amazing.
And a beret. It's a really good look.
Look, I just love a crushed velour tracksuit. That's just me. That's who I am.
Makes you comfortable. As we mentioned, this is a podcast about speedy race cars. We got two races to talk about here because we were off last week. So we're gonna catch up on what happened in Monaco, the French-speaking, not France, country of Monaco, and then transition into the French-speaking, non-France country of Canada. So,
yeah, apologies to those who do not follow us on Patreon or Twitter, who maybe didn't know where last week's podcast went. We had our ringer set up, but unfortunately, there was a last-minute emergency of sorts, and we had to cancel it. So more to talk about this week. People were very happy that they got to listen to Rob talk about Ferrari's issues, shall we say.
Should we jump right into it? Qualifying?
Sure. Yeah. Do you want me to take it?
Yeah, please.
Sure. I mean, let's talk about practice first of all, because practice was actually pretty interesting and sort of was a little bit of a nod towards what was going to happen, especially in relation to one Charles Leclerc or Ferrari kind of in general. Grip was a little bit tough when they went out for FP1 the first time. Everyone was kind of spinning. Both us spun and almost busted one of his wheels. He went into the barrier. Gasly had a bit of a dangerous wobble at the swimming pool, and Kubica straight up did a 90 degree turn at Casino Square and was very lucky not to damage his car as well. There was also plenty of complaining about these really wide cars on the Monaco streets getting in each other's way. I think Hamilton was complaining, as he sort of is wont to do, but it did give us one of the best Kimi Raikkonen lines of the year, which was, I have that Force India or whatever the fuck it's called. Kimmy not up to speed on the new names for some of the teams this year. Then there was an interesting situation where the Haas got black flagged. Did you see this?
No.
So their radios weren't working. They sent them out and the pit couldn't communicate with them. So the only way they could get them to come back in was Haas asked the FIA to black flag the two drivers.
Oh my gosh, really?
Yeah. So they
already don't we have pit boards? Isn't that what they're for?
Yeah, I thought so. Maybe the pit boards are hard in Monaco because it's, you know, they're on the inside of it of the turn. I don't know.
Skid it like an expo board, just a dry race.
So they straight off, they black flagged them, I think, on their second lap.
That's
out,
funny.
To bring them back in. Hamilton was fastest in FP1. FP2 he was as well. The only thing of note there was Alexander Albon had an absolutely wild lap. Ended up coming fifth. He, of course, the pole sitter in Formula 2 last year in Monaco. He's very comfortable there. And then FP3 was where things got a little bit wrong for Ferrari. Vettel went into the wall and Leclerc went out. He was behind when it happened with a bit of a gap, but he didn't slow down enough and almost got a penalty for it. He had to go to the stewards for not slowing down. It wasn't the only dangerous thing that happened on that corner as well, which we'll probably get into in the race. There was some interesting sort of steward danger stuff or marshals around that area. Who else? I'm sorry. Magnussen and Stroll had a little bit of a coming together as well. But all in all, they were sort of, everyone was happy enough with pace by the time FP3 was over. And then qualifying. Vettel sort of started quali the way he finished FP3 by tapping the barriers. He seemed to be touching the track practically everywhere, really pushing the limit. There's been a couple of news posts about Ferrari just not really having the grip this year, and I think at Monaco it really showed. But the big sort of story of qualifying happened rather surprisingly in Q1. and it kind of crept up on every. It was like watching a car crash in slow motion where you're not really sure if this is happening, and then by the time you realize what's happening, it had already happened.
Or like like crash mode in Burnout, where you think this it's not going to rack up a whole bunch of points, and then that bus comes out of nowhere, and then you just get millions and millions of points.
Right. So I guess what happened was that with less than a minute left, Leclerc was in the pits. I think he was in 12th position at this time. At the end of... Okay, Rob's go for it.
Well, I think if you only look at the moment where this became irretrievable,
right,
you're not giving the full picture. Because, like, the issue here is that Leclerc sat in the pits while time ticked down, while he was in a vulnerable position, and ends up not making the cut into Q2. What was interesting for me, I didn't get to watch this quali live. So I watched this. I got in late last night. I was watching it this morning. So I had the benefit of knowing it was going to happen. And so I'm just watching. For me, the story becomes like, how does this go wrong? And if you watch it from that standpoint, a series of things begin happening with 8 minutes left, which is Leclerc is on a hot lap. And he basically throws the lap away, throws the tires away with a huge lockup, heading into the final corner, right? And he has to come in. 8 minutes is already, like, if you think about it, like, you know, time to a change, find a different gap in the traffic, send someone out for not, like eight minutes left, you really probably can't afford to be throwing laps away at that point. So watching it from that standpoint, like, Leclerc had chances to prevent disaster here, right? The reason you end up, like, sometimes the reason you get into trouble is the reason you don't get out of it, I think. And so, like, looking at it from that standpoint, Leclerc begins to become the author of his own misfortunes with yet another lapse in qualifying. But then it gets really interesting because so I think it's as he now comes in and is trying to recover from that, he's thrown the tires away, he pulls into the pits, and he misses the weighbridge. He's called in for a weighing, and he just cruises right past the glowing readout summoning his number to the weighbridge. He pulls into the pit box, and immediately everyone is like yelling at him, weighbridge, weighbridge, weighbridge. He's very lucky. Ferrari have a good pit box position, so they can just like roll him back onto the weighbridge. It's excruciating because it takes forever, and it looks like there's a weird... It was weird. Like, it seems like you have to roll onto the weighbridge in a particular way, because they like had him up on it, and then they rolled him off the front lip of it, and then rolled him back onto it. Like, I don't know, you can't just put the car on there, it has to roll on from the right direction. I have no idea, but the entire thing takes forever. And so, you know, it was 8 minutes, I think, when he locked his tires. By the time the weighbridge thing is sorted out, he's down to 7 minutes, six minutes. And then he goes into the garage. And you assume at that point he's going to come back out. And then right around that time, Vettel just once again drifts into a wall and just slaps the side of the tires into the wall. And he has to come in for a tire change. And this is where things get weird. Now, Vettel is doing this, and with the outlap timing, now he's in trouble of not getting, because he is definitely below the cutoff. He was in like 17th when he slaps the wall. And so he has to come in, get a tire change done, go back on an outlap, get a hot lap in. He's already in the danger zone. But what's weird is nothing seems to have happened with Leclerc's car. You see the nose of it still sitting in the garage. Nothing was happening. Vettel comes in. They put the new tires on him. He goes out. It's pretty dramatic. Everyone is out there trying to make the cut, and Leclerc keeps falling from, like, 13th. He's coming closer and closer. And it's could there be anything more perfect than the way this shakes out? Leclerc's clinging to the last position above the cut. Vettel is out there. Time's expired. Vettel's just on a blindingly fast lap. He goes purple and jumps to first, and that pushes Leclerc out of the running. And he's day done. And nobody seemed to know why he wasn't out there, because there was time to get him out. Like, they had time to do the tire change on Vettel. Why didn't Leclerc make it out there in between his Weybridge incident and Vettel being sent back out there? What the hell happened in Ferrari? And you saw him asking people on his side of the garage what happened. There didn't seem to be any answers. But to me, I knew this had happened. I talked to some people on Twitter, and I was fully prepared to be like, man, Ferrari just totally screwed it up. And in a way, yes. But I don't think it's the pit wall side is just the one that screwed it up. Like, to me, this entire weekend just began feeling like, man, Ferrari is a team that can't shoot straight. The drivers screw up, you know, at a troubling rate, which means you're back-footed constantly. They came into quali on the back foot because Vettel binned his car in practice three. And so I had a weird degree of sympathy for how this all goes wrong, because to a degree, Leclerc shouldn't have been in that position.
Yeah, and that's what he did to his tires, I think, ends up, at least from what Ferrari says, that ends up being the linchpin here, because according to an article on motorsport.com, Ferrari took the risk in trying to save a set of tires because it felt an extra set was necessary to try to fight Mercedes and Red Bull in Q3. Ferrari team principal Mattia Binotto said that the cutoff time was erroneously managed because Ferrari had not factored in such significant track improvement or the gains drivers would make as they built their confidence through Q1. He's sitting in the garage and they're like, all right, by our calculations, no one, or he's going to be safe because the cutoff time, he's within the cutoff time. So let's you know, roll the dice a little bit here so we can save our tires and take the fight to Mercedes and Red Bull. Go ahead, Danny.
I think it's crazy, though, that like they didn't at least have him in the chamber just in case, because it wasn't like there was that much of a safe zone. Like, they knew drivers like Hülkenberg and Vettel were going to skip him. They knew Albon was hot in FP the whole weekend, so they knew he was probably going to skip him. So at the end, it was Norris, Albon, Hülkenberg, and Vettel which skipped him, I think, in the last 2 minutes, right? So what time do you need to send somebody at Monaco to get them around? I mean, you have to find a gap.
It's like a minute 40 for the out.
Right. So by the time that happened, those were the four drivers underneath him. Albon, I think, jumped him literally one position, and the rest of them shot way up higher, including Hülkenberg, I think, was three places ahead of him. So it's crazy that they were, like, he was still walking around with his, you know, with his lid off in the garage by the time it was over. So it seemed like I totally understand. You know, there are races to try and get high in FP3, in Q3. It's not to try and get into Q2. That's not what their big problem is. Like, but it seems crazy to think that they weren't, you know, just a little bit more cautious, especially in a place like Monaco, where you could just shoot somebody back out again, just and try and get it done. You know,
does it? To me, all of this is starting to sound like one of two things is happening. One, Ferrari is just imploding and incompetent. I don't think that's the whole story. I wonder if, because they are just getting trounced by Mercedes, and there is that ever-present pressure of being Ferrari, you know, holding that torch for the historic company and for the entire country of Italy, the pressure is there to take large risks, because that's the only thing that's going to get you anywhere. If you are conservative and you put Leclerc back out on some new tires, yeah, that'll get you into Q2. But if that had happened, then we'd still be saying, like, you know, Leclerc qualified sixth or something. Ferrari just doesn't have it. And like this, everything remains the same. Whereas if you do roll the dice here, and he does get through, and you can take the fight to Mercedes and Red Bull in Q3, maybe on the outside chance, Leclerc gets way closer to the front, and you can finally get a race win, maybe, you know?
My short sort of answer to that is that I feel like this year, Ferrari, none of their, like, glasses are full. Like, they're all... They're struggling in every department a little bit, but I do feel like the compounding issue is that just the car is not there. You talk Hamilton talking about their Mercedes this year, and he doesn't feel like it's really where it should be or where it was. Vettel and Leclerc are like really good drivers. Vettel, I think, has a really good head on his shoulders, and I think Leclerc does too. We talk so much about how much confidence he has, and he seems to be, you know, able to get through really difficult, stressful positions. Both of them have been their cars in like qualifying and practice, and have tripped up during the race as well. It just seems like I'm not saying the car isn't there. I'm saying that the driver and the car I don't think they feel confident in where that car is, where the grip is, and they're trying to push it that little bit more, and it's just not there for them.
It's such a hard thing to read from the outside. I'm at a point where I think I've seen enough. Binotto needs to not be the person like running race weekends. Like it's possible. Like try a different management structure. If this is the guy who really should be running the race program, the entire Ferrari program,
right?
That's fine. Like, he can be a team principal, but then, like, try an arrangement where you're a team principal and then you've got, like, a shot caller or a play caller during the race, because clearly there is an issue with how they are running this. And the thing about Binotto is that, one, I think my suspicion is he is getting gentler press coverage than you might expect, because the press hated the last guy. Maurizio Rivabene came across like an asshole. Binotto is nice. And there is a narrative out there, and I don't know how well-founded it is. My suspicion is, pit lane gossip tends to be pretty... You have a pretty good sense of how things are going. The rap on Rivabene, and we talked about this mid-season in our special edition where we were like, we got to talk about the Ferrari situation. The rap on Rivabene was that he was an asshole. And not a very technically minded asshole. So he didn't know what he didn't know, and he was a jerk, and the press didn't like him. And the idea was, by moving out of there, you're bringing in Binotto, who did know what he was doing, is a good engineer, good technician, and he would be able to sort of right the ship. And I don't necessarily think that plan is off the table. If you think about it, he's only been running the show for, let's see, about 6 months now. And he wouldn't have been empowered to oversee completely the technical development of this year's Ferrari. Like, he is somewhat responsible for the performance of this car, but also he has sort of been dealt a tough hand here. And I think a lot of the things that have gone wrong, and I think this is very much to your point, Danny, is that Ferrari are making mistakes that you make when you are trying to create pace when you don't have it.
Yeah.
And I think maybe that is some of what is going on. But I also think at this point there is a lack of steadiness in the Ferrari pits on race weekends that is undermining their performance. Like, they have bled out a lot. More so than even the pace of their car, like they are up against it now with Red Bull to an extent. Like if Gasly were not such a sort of damp squib in that Red Bull, Ferrari would be in much deeper trouble. I think that there's something going on from the top to bottom with that team. And to me, it is just nerve-wracking to watch, because you've got Vettel making mistakes. Yeah, he's pushing, but like, he was making mistakes last year. He gets into a weird headspace. At this point, Leclerc, these are formative years for a driver. He's in the Ferrari pressure cooker. Things keep going wrong, and now he's increasingly making them go wrong, and he doesn't trust his team. That's not a good precedent to set. Like, think about this. If you were Leclerc's manager, would you not be terrified at this point? Would you not be thinking, like, shit, like, would we have been better served by leaving him in the Sauber for a year, in the Alpha for a year, rather than...
Last year he qualified 14th in a Sauber.
Yeah. So, like, I think for me, it's just when it comes to race weekends, that team, like, there needs to be some sort of order and reason brought to Ferrari. Again, the thing I suspect is Vettel knocking out his tires at that particular moment is what screwed it up. Like, yes, they were making a gamble, but I also just have this feeling that whenever too many things happen at Ferrari at once, they tend to freeze and hold things in place and focus on one problem at a time. And I don't think they're good at sort of spinning all the plates. And I think that is just kind of the hallmark of this era in Ferrari. And I don't know, maybe what was keeping the lid on that was the Kimi factor. You no longer have a guy who's going to be there at the back of the pits, you know, decades of experience under his belt being like, you know, are we supposed to sit here with our thumbs up our asses? Or are we going to race? Like, that is, you know, that is an energy he could bring to the team. He had that authority. I don't know. There's a weird chemistry issue. There's a management issue. But I think at this point, like, somebody else needs to be running the show on race weekends, or they need to devolve decision making.
It's going to be interesting to watch this year's Drive to Survive, because, like, it definitely does feel it's not one thing. You can't point towards one thing. It feels in a way like when a baseball team's in a rut, like they need to get the fuck out of whatever this is. Then, like, it's toxic, and it's probably making every weekend following even more difficult. Do you want me to round out qualifying?
Yeah, let's do it.
Just to get out of it. Not all that much shocking happened after the fact. Hulkenberg, Norris, Grosjean, Raikkonen, and Giovinazzi out in Q2. Grosjean got held up, I believe it was by Verstappen, It was Gasly, sorry.
That's a rough, like, I didn't see it during the broadcast, but I watched it on the onboards, and it's scary. Bad. He's got a scram on the brakes.
Yeah, it's in a weird spot. It's right before that turn, this little mini straight with the bump they weave right before the Lowe's hairpin, he slammed on the brakes, and then he didn't realize he didn't have enough time. He went over the radio, and they said, that's it, we can get out for another, right? And they were like, no, and he was devastated. The other thing that happened of note really in Q3 was that Vettel once again tapped the barrier on its final lap, I think entering swimming pool. He was pretty lucky on this one, a real sort of tank slapper on the right rear. It ended up as a result, no Ferrari in the podium spots anyway, with Hamilton in first, Bottas beside him, Verstappen, then Vettel, Gasly, Ricciardo, Magnussen, Kvyat, Albon, and Sainz rounding up the top 10. So nice little mixture there.
Yep. Then we got Hulkenberg, Norris, Grosjean, Raikkonen, Leclerc in 15th after Antonio Giovinazzi and Pierre Gasly were penalized 3 places for impeding. Then we got Perez, Stroll, Giovinazzi, Russell, and Kubica. Magnussen said he hit the wall also on his run and claims that if he had not done that, he would have gone 4th, which is not unreasonable, because he was, Vettel did a 110.947, and Magnussen did a 111.109. So what is that? Less than 0.2 of a second.
Right.
That would have been nuts. Do you want to keep on,
sure.
Danny? I didn't take notes on this race, so I don't have a whole lot here.
Yeah, apologies in advance. Everyone is used to Drew's incredible play-by-plays. I'll absolutely do my best. I'm used to the first lap, if nothing else. So it'll start well, and I'll go downhill from there. All eyes again on Hamilton and Bottas, but also I think with the track layout here in Monaco, you're kind of always, especially with Verstappen in third, you're always kind of looking at that little battle that's going on there. Again, as Bottas has had such haphazard starts, and Hamilton's been relatively consistent for the season that's in it. As expected, that's kind of the way it went. Hamilton had a good start, sort of was on the outside, coming up to that nice turn, which means you're in a good track position as long as you stay ahead. Bottas, on the other hand, started off half decently, but Verstappen sort of caught up with him pretty quickly. to Valtteri's credit, though, and it felt like a very 2019 Valtteri move, he held his ground. He held his ground. He didn't go out wide to try and retain grip. He sort of believed in himself and the car and kept the position. Didn't necessarily force. I also think like 2019 Bottas, Verstappen is probably keeping a little bit of distance from, whereas like in previous years, maybe he wouldn't have. He did well by the time they were going up the hill. He was ahead of him.
It was an interesting moment. Bottas couldn't go any wider than he went, is the thing. Like, it was an interesting response to Verstappen, because to me it looked like Verstappen was going to get him in turn one.
Yes.
And, like, Verstappen, I think, was leading him by a nose, and he had the inside line. And you do kind of figure that Max being Max is not going to give you an inch, and he's going to, you know, sort of squirt ahead. What was interesting to me was Bottas almost like ran like a slot car on the outside track. Like he almost took the approach where he wasn't racing against Verstappen. He was doing a time trial, and he was just like holding his line, and what was going to happen was going to happen. And I think if he'd reacted, he would have lost the position, but instead he just kind of executes this sort of fast outside line while Verstappen has to bring his nose back in the line for the straight. And, you know, Bottas just gets ahead.
Something you can do at Monaco, you know, stick to the racing line and like, you'll probably be all right.
That's
just
the thing.
So narrow.
Yeah.
And it's also, I think Monaco's such an interesting case for the start finish trade as well, because the start grid is really close to turn one. Like, there's not really all that much space. So in that case, it's not like the braking zone itself is particularly large. So I think that the drivers are able to react to themselves. Like, they need to be able to react to themselves because they're so bunched up by the time they hit that first turn, in a way that there really aren't a lot of other. And it's also not wide at all. Like, it's very tight as well. It's 2x2, basically, which is why you saw so many cars going up the inside again this year. I wonder if the fact that Valtteri, he took a strong line, and I wonder if it was just a case that Verstappen knew where he was going. Like, he knew the angle. Once he had like committed to that part of the track, he knew where he was going. So it's like that whole thing of when there's indecision and both drivers don't know what the other one's doing, sometimes you end up having a problem. Whereas if you know what the other driver's doing, then it's, you know, he kind of makes Max's mind up for him almost. Yeah, but apart from that, they were all clean throughout the first lap. The only thing was Kimi on Stroll on the hairpin. They had a little bit of a tap there. They were pretty much all happy in their nappies going through.
Did you watch the onboards for that opening lap?
Not separately.
YouTube clip? Okay, yeah.
No, I've not seen the highlights.
They have an onboard of Sainz's start, and it's crazy. I think he called it like the best overtakes of his career.
Oh, cool.
And it's amazing. Like, he does this thing, it looks like he's just keeping his foot to the floor and hopes that that he keeps momentum and that the cars get out of the way, and they do. And it's just, I don't know, it's kind of magical. I will link it in the show notes.
Shall I keep going?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, the next things I have is all Leclerc.
Yes. It's all Leclerc, and it seems to be all Rascasse as well. That's kind of where the action was at this year, which is a shame because there's not really all that much seating there. Although if you're up on the hill, I think you've a pretty good view of it. Leclerc had this little, I guess, interestingly, considering it's kind of where he binned his tire or flat spotted his tire on his qualifying lap, but he had this tactic of taking a ridiculously tight line through Rascasse. Like, you have to imagine at this stage, Leclerc is way under. You know, he's off position by 10 places. He's trying to gobble up as many positions as he can as early in the race,
and he's doing it. Like, this was really cool to watch.
And it's you know, I feel like the first three laps of these races, tire strategy goes out the window. People are fighting for position. Especially in this race, for F1 cars to be this close or this tight packed together for the first couple of laps, it's kind of unique in F1 at least. So they really, really go for it. I think it was lap five, he went up the inside of Grosjean at Rascasse. A little bit of a dangerous or gutsy, shall we say, move. But he makes a stick and goes past him. And then
he got by Norris at the hairpin before that.
Right, yeah.
Which is a little bump and grind there.
Yeah.
But it was a good move.
And then he tries to do the same thing on lap 9 with Nico Hülkenberg. Initially, I thought that Hülkenberg had just either not seen him or closed the door. But it was kind of what we talked about, weirdly, before the Monaco race. We were talking about the old cars used to have the wider arses on them, right? They used to have the wheels used to be a bit more wide than the front was. So they used to kind of drift a little bit around the corners. They had to be careful. If they went through a corner and they touched it with their front wing, couldn't be sure that the back of the car was going to make it. Obviously, that's not the case in modern F1 cars. But that's basically what happened, is he turned in kind of slightly too early at Raskas, and his rear right hit the back of it. He spun. I don't actually think he made any contact with Hülkenberg at all.
I think Hülkenberg's rear right tire kind of crunched into his floor.
Okay. So
that's what it looked like from the replay.
And then worse, so he spins, but then worse, he picked up a puncture, and worse again, he didn't notice until, you know, you've basically got half a turn there to figure it out and go into your pits right away. But they didn't notice it was a puncture until, I don't actually know, where was it, up by the chicane or the Lowe's hairpin, or was it earlier than that? But unfortunately, he decides to, I don't know, book it back as fast as possible to the pits, and completely tears apart, not just the tire, it doesn't really matter, but he in doing so just like shreds the bottom of his car. That, you know, tires are rubber ain't light, you can't just fling that stuff around, and it was basically like flapping off the rear of his car and the underside of his car until he got back to the pits. So, you know, even at that stage, he's obviously lost a lot of positions. Not terrible for tire strategy, pitting at 9. I think the rest of them came in at 11. But unfortunately, he completely banjacks the bottom of his car in rushing back so fast.
Yeah, and I mean, may as well just skip to the part where, yeah, he only lasts another 9 laps, I think, and then retires, because you need those parts of your car.
What was funny to me is, first of all, you had Martin Brundle there saying that it looked like, you know, basically in so many words, Leclerc was having a bit of a temper tantrum out there.
Right.
You know, that you're supposed to go slowly and you should know that. And instead he just rips it apart. But then the other funny part was that Leclerc was ultimately the one who basically made the call to call the race. And he was like, look, I don't want to give up, but this car is really tough to drive. And again, it just was another moment that underscored for me, like, man, who is in charge at, like why is Leclerc the one to make? He's calmed down. Now he's making the call, like, we should probably abandon this race and save the engine and stop running. But what's funny to me is that it had been clear for a few laps by this point that, like, Leclerc's one chance was to pull some wild moves in the opening laps of the race. And once he trashed that tire and trashed the floor of the car, that was probably day done. And yet they kind of left him out there to sort of flounder about a bit longer until he basically said, we need to call this off. It was another weird moment of, it feels like people, like, there needs to be more steadiness and proactive direction coming from the pit wall than there is. And instead it's left to not a rookie driver, but damn close, certainly a Ferrari rookie, to basically be the one to admit that this thing is unsalvageable.
Yeah, and like, that was a big red flag. But also, you could argue that it's interesting that nobody made a strong call to tell him to slow down when he was going around, because he did, like, a lot of the lap at that speed. And second of all, that, like, maybe I'm being a little bit unfair, but I feel like the first thing you do if your driver clipped the wall that close to the pits is fucking check telemetry to make sure that there's not a problem with that rear tire. And it looked like it was shagged. So, like, maybe that's being a little bit unfair and asking too much, but would you not err on the side of caution anyway? If you're 2 laps from the pit window and he's just smashed the tire, even if it's not out, like, there's probably some damage done to it, would you not just pull him in anyway? Maybe that's,
well, hold on, think about, I'm thinking about track layout, because the thing I don't know is, he basically did come to a complete halt after clipping it with his back tire, But then he gets underway really quickly after that. And this all happens probably before anyone at Ferrari has a chance to get on the radio and say anything, right, or even check a screen. By the time you would have processed that, like, he had just clipped his tire, is there a risk that the tire's compromised? He's probably already past the pit entry.
Yes, it's a fair point, because maybe in my head I'm thinking about the next thing that happens at Rascas, where people are hanging around a little bit longer.
By the way, I will say I feel good that I saw that incident. I feel felt really validated by people just repeatedly, like, catching their tires on the walls and clipping the inside of Rascas. Because literally, this is, I said, like, before, in the pre-race, I was like, I can't drive this track because this shit always happens to me. I cannot judge, like, Rascas in particular, it feels like you've got a tight inside line, you're feeling good, and then you hear, like, a thud, and the entire car slews around. And I was like, that's just me, that's just me being a fool playing on a console. This never would have happened with track IR, where I could have, like, spot checked the corner. And, like, here, just, like, repeatedly, like, drivers who know this track inside and out are just, just beating the hell out of the guardrails with their tires. I did feel like someone wrote in a couple weeks ago about, like, are these cars just, like, way too freaking long? And I was like, I don't think that's the problem. And then around this track, it's all I could see. Holy shit, these things are gigantic.
Yeah, I was thinking that as well, where, like, we kind of argued that that wasn't that big a deal. I think it was watching them on the hairpin as well, being like, Jesus, they can't even turn and get past each other.
But that's a Monaco issue. It's been like, you can cut these cars in half and Monaco is still basically unfit as a race course.
Yeah. If Herman Zilke turned up tomorrow with a track, if Monaco didn't exist and went, here you go, people would be like, what the fuck have you done? give us back your massive runoff areas and that little weird turn you have in China and Singapore that you love putting in places.
Speaking of wild moves, before we get to the next Rascas thing, in the pits, everyone decides to pit around, like you said, Danny, lap 11. Let's see, at that point,
Hamilton goes in first, right?
Yeah, it's Hamilton and then Bottas, Verstappen, Vettel. That's the running order. Hamilton goes in first, and then it's Bottas and Verstappen who pit kind of at the same time.
So they kind of, don't they double stop? Like, Hamilton goes in and then Bottas kind of slows down a little bit, right?
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
Red Bull releases Verstappen pretty much directly into the side of Valtteri Bottas, and Verstappen being Verstappen just keeps on trucking, does not, give him any space at all. Bottas has nowhere to go. I don't think any damage occurred, but I do think Verstappen's tire, like, bumps his front wing. It takes a while for the stewards to hand down a penalty, but Verstappen does eventually get a 5-second time penalty for that unsafe release, which will, have a part to play in later in the race. But five laps after that, we're back at Rascas.
Yeah, and then I guess we weren't done with the spinning, but this one involved Antonio Giovinazzi, and they said Russell, I think, during it, but it was definitely Robert Kubica, right?
Yeah, it's Kubica.
Kubica had actually done, like, pretty well. Like, he'd made up a couple of places. I think he was in, maybe, was it 16th, perhaps, by the time this happened? Giovinazzi basically spins Kubica, has him almost facing backwards down the track, and it creates a sort of a, if this was in the game, they'd all go into ghost mode and drive through Robert, because it was just like one of those stupid AI breaking, nobody knows what to do in this situation. Holds up like a bunch of drivers for like 3 or 4 seconds, maybe longer actually, as they slowly try and get around the back of Kubica's car, including Russell as well, who ends up getting ahead of him then, who was driving last place at that time. So it sticks Robert in the back of the pack, unfortunately.
Yep, and then, as we said, Leclerc retires a few laps later. We've got another Stroll on Raikkonen incident.
Yeah, lap 38 at the Lowe's hairpin again. Kimi just loving tapping people. He's not ahead of him, but I guess Stroll kind of drives as if Kimi's not there at all. Mm-hmm. But considering there are two right-handers coming up, I'm not really sure Kimi was going to be able to like overtake him before he got to the tunnel. That's sort of the position you're usually in where you try and make a dive down into the chicane after the tunnel, but I guess Kimi being Kimi just wanted the fucking Force India to get it, whatever it's called.
Whatever the fuck it's called.
Yeah. Raikkonen did hit Stroll on lap one, so this is maybe...
Right.
There were some repercussions from that.
So
Sorry, go ahead, Rob.
I just am curious about the whole Bottas pit stop and all that. What did you guys make of just the entire way that played out? Because we've seen Mercedes pull off like a masterful double stack earlier this year. And at the time I was like, oh, I hate the double stack. And clearly, you know, more the fool eye, they know what they're doing. This one felt very much like this is why you don't do that though. Pit stop. And I'm curious what you guys made of the call, to bring them both in.
I thought this was maybe the riskiest place to do it, because over the course of the weekend, it never looked like Mercedes were that much ahead of everyone. And over the course of the race, they were never really that much ahead of everyone. Like there was a couple of seconds, but it was never like Hamilton was disappearing into the distance, which considering it was Verstappen as well, I guess the Red Bull and Monaco might be a good combination, but it was like Bottas did have to slow down to create the gap. Like this wasn't... And then you're always rolling the dice a little bit, because it's, you know, the Red Bulls are very sharp at pit stops, and so is Ferrari. It's not like there is the chance, even if you don't fuck your pit stop up, that you're gonna, you know, especially with the position of the boxes where they are, like they're bang 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 basically right on top of each other, that you know, there's a margin for error there. So yeah, I don't know. It's the narrative of them sacrificing Bottas for Hamilton has existed so long now that it sort of gets magnetized to. I'm not really sure if that is necessarily the case. I mean, that's ultimately what happens, but also it was an unsafe release, right? Like they really shouldn't have put him out there. So if all things being fair, it would have worked, but it didn't, because hey, guess what? Max Verstappen goes when he gets a chance. What did you think?
I think just what you said, it was probably within their margins, and I think that's what you have to do.
What do you think, Rob, of the risk of an undercut if they hadn't?
You see, this is the thing. Like, I know more about what the tires were doing on Hamilton's car because he's more expressive. Like, Hamilton will leave a radio trail of the state of his car and how he's feeling about it in a way that few other drivers do. Valtteri certainly doesn't. And so you had Hamilton saying that the softs he started the race on were shot to shit. And so I think the very real risk is that if Valtteri was in a similar position and he stays out and everyone else pits... He certainly couldn't have then pit, because the safety car is sitting there at the Lowe's hairpin, right? So like the safety car is basically parked in Lowe's waiting for the first car to round the corner, catch up with it. And then the safety car, I think, was out there for two full laps, maybe three. Mm. And so I think at that point, if Valtteri stays out, he needs to have a good stint on those softs from the lead for a while for the entire thing to pay off. And I'm not sure that... it would have, but at the same time, like, track position is so crucial that I don't know. To me, it feels like it probably was in the end the right move. It might set, like, leaving Valtteri out there might have sacrificed him more completely, but at the same time, like, they did really roll the dice there, and it certainly cost Valtteri at least a place. What's interesting is that Mercedes later clarified that it was Hamilton's fault. So this
was
is the
he
other,
slow?
No, he clipped a wheel gun exiting the pit box, And apparently that slowed down. Like they had to reset the gun, reset the position as Valtteri's coming in. And that slowed everything down just enough to make the difference. Hmm. That interested me as well, because I don't know why you'd say that. Like, to me, I wouldn't say like, oh, you know who really fucked this up was Lewis Hamilton. You know, like, first of all, what's it like? What you think? I don't think he can see where a gun is on the exit. So I don't know. It's funny to me that Mercedes went out there and clarified that like what went wrong was that the first stop had a pretty standard, you know, probably guns get knocked about a bit.
But doesn't matter, right?
Yeah.
Because you're double stacking.
And a double stack, it was just enough to throw things off. But it's interesting that they sort of put their hand up and said that's what unfolded there. I'm weirdly forgiving of Max on this one, because that pit lane is so... if you're a driver, you don't know. They tell you to go. You go. And
they're literally in front of him as well. So it's not like they can't possibly see.
Yeah,
and until it's too late, right?
Bail out and let Valtteri by, because you've got pit boxes to your left. Like, there's not two cars of distance between the pit boxes and the wall. So he basically had to just bull ahead there. I don't know. It was an interesting sequence. I am just sort of fascinated by the counterfactual of Valtteri stays out there and pushes those softs to the theoretical limit. And how does that change the race?
Well, and the other thing that happened in those pits, of course, as well, is that they decided to put Hamilton on the mediums, which at the time was the opposite strategy to Vettel, who went on the hards at that stage, right? And they both have about 67 laps left, I think.
Yeah.
So... I guess maybe at the time there was so much going on that it didn't become part of the narrative of the race, but it certainly was the narrative of the final 20 laps of the race.
Go on. Sorry. The next thing I have is lap 45.
Yeah, Magnussen and Perez, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. This is one of a couple of... I mean, every year, man, this chicane, it's just like... it's just silly at this... Like, you know, they extended the wall, or they pulled it back to stop people from crashing into it or getting caught and hitting, you know, they had that little exit down the side. But the bumps, I think, were lowered down a little bit. But it's just gotten to the stage now where, I don't know, everyone's at fault. Either people are ahead or closing the gap last second, or the people at the back are just throwing their cars down the inside and throwing their hands in the air and seeing what happens. But on this one, I mean, Magnussen had a decent... I think attempt on Perez. Perez decided to close the door. Magnussen had to, you know.
I thought it was the other way around.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, you're right. Sorry.
I guess Perez on the inside of Magnussen. Yeah.
And then Perez complains about Magnussen calling a chicane. That's the thing everyone does as
well.
What
are you going
to do? What the fuck are you supposed to do? Hit you? Or yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah. Then we get into a little bit of trouble where around lap 48, the back markers and the leaders are all just on top of each other. And Bottas gets held up pretty badly by Lance Stroll, or Stroll, who's not really making many friends this race. He's just getting in everyone's way, it seems, at this stage.
I did like, though, that this is where it starts to... that narrative starts to play out, where Hamilton is on these medium tires, Verstappen is closing on him, and you look at the lap number and it's 48 of 78 and you're like, oh man, and we're hitting back markers, here we go.
It seems like it's happening way too soon, and they're only seconds behind. Like, Vettel is only a second and a half behind Verstappen as well. I'm not sure if Verstappen has gotten his penalty at this stage. I feel like he has, and
I think they've issued it, but you know,
so at this stage we're kind of thinking, okay, the only way that Verstappen wins this race if he clears Lewis and then gets 5 seconds ahead of him, which you'd bet him to do, because he's getting held up on the wrong tires. While at the same time there's this storm that's been sort of missing the track this whole it's like a wedding day and everyone's looking at their their apps. It's just skimming it. It's never coming, but it's always there. Like,
that's
this,
right. So, I forgot about the threat of rain.
So they're kind of, so you know, I think Hamilton comes over the radio chatting to Bono, you know, complaining about why you put me on these tires, I can't keep the car behind me, all that sort of stuff. And they're kind of thinking, all right, Hamilton to retain position at this stage is he's praying for rain, right? So he, throughout this period, manages to keep pace. But by the time they reach the last like eight laps, I think Verstappen, it comes over mode set, as you said, for Max Verstappen to really push for the last couple of laps. Hamilton at this stage is just like skidding. He's like, he's skating on ice, but without wearing skates. What do you call that? He's dancing on ice.
They even tell him, like, Verstappen's been given permission to push. And Hamilton says something like, oh, great.
Yeah, cool. Great news. Yeah.
Great news.
And then I guess it's just, it's that Hamilton just is, like, we forget it. Or, you know, he's in a good car and all this sort of stuff. But, like, Hamilton is, as much as he is vocal about tires and how much he hates like making them last, he's incredibly good at making them last. And this race, I mean, perhaps there is no better track to have to be in this position, because there's not a long straight where you're struggling for grip on an apex entering it and they can gobble you up or whatever. But it's still like, it's not an easy task. The one spot where they have a chance to do it is coming out of the tunnel, leading down into that chicane. And Verstappen does try it on lap 76. But as Martin Brundle put it, it wasn't an overtake. It was a mugging. This was, I will say, an optimistic attempt at trying to get past him. Not only at this stage do I not think Verstappen has enough laps in the race to clear 5 seconds, even if he gets past him. Not that that's going to stop Max Verstappen. He almost, I'm not sure if he locks up, but he like throws the car down the inside, actually makes contact with Lewis. Lewis does see him beforehand and straightens up a bit, but he still gets knocked to clear the chicane. And then Verstappen gives out saying that he cut the chicane, which is just what everyone does when that happens, which I loved his optimism. He said he just turns in and I'm trying to overtake, he said. And it's like, he just turns in. It's a fucking corner. Yeah, thankfully they both limp around. They're both fine. And that's how the race ends. But yeah, God bless Max Verstappen's optimism. He's a trier.
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting. You know, I was looking for articles ahead of this podcast, and I found one that sort of, it talks about how Mark Webber and Nico Rosberg, their reactions to Hamilton's drive.
Yeah.
Because it's, you know, like you said, Hamilton is good at tires, and we know that he is in a good car, but how good is Hamilton really? Is kind of a question that, you know, I think it's normal to wonder about when he is in, you know, the Mercedes. so I thought it was interesting to hear other drivers sort of comment on his skill. And Webber says he knew he was never going to pit, but it was a very, very torturous way to win a Grand Prix. You could see he had no front grip. Rotation was notorious in Lowe's, Rasquez, Portier. And obviously when you've got the added ingredient of Max Verstappen behind you on a different compound of tire, it's a big bit of a headache. He had a bit of a wobble mentally in the middle, but a very, very measured drive, which you'd expect. I didn't expect for him for 1 minute to put it in the wall. I expected him to run out of grip or something to happen to Max, but I didn't expect an unforced error from him. And this is exactly what I think of Hamilton, is like this robot who never, ever makes a mistake.
Which is so funny, because like his early career was not the opposite, but was definitely more in that. I mean, he's been consistent, but rushes of blood to the head. Although we've talked about it before, a lot of that was fanned by the sort of media, stereotyping of him.
Sure.
Well, I think it's also funny to me the degree to which his, what's the word about this? His emotion on track. The fact that he's so obviously vocal about when he doesn't like something, when he's obviously nervous about something. But the other thing that sort of reveals is that he hates tire management. He constantly worries about tire strategy. But the other thing that that's revealed in that is he's so enormously sensitive to this stuff. That right. like he has this really good sense of, oh, these tires feel like, you know, these tires are gone. They feel like trash. And immediately enters like conservation mode and like protection mode.
30 laps from the finish.
Yeah, and that's the funny thing is, on the one hand, he's on the radio, you hear him and it's like, oh man, he is panicking, he's melting down. And I think maybe once upon a time that would have been closer to the truth. But now the funny thing is, it's all tempered by this expertise and skill. And so there's this weird thing that is happening in Hamilton's drives right now, where in terms of demeanor and reaction, he's a bit reactionary. He almost seems to overreact. But he's got this skill and discipline that his overreactions end up being really productive, right? That like he ends up being more finely tuned to the ways the car is going off and compensating for it in a way that I'm not sure other drivers sense and certainly may not be able to execute on for 60 some laps of steadily worsening and concerning performance.
He also has the best. Can we talk about the handshake? Did you guys see the podium?
I didn't see this.
Oh my God. This is
so
good.
Please describe.
So they have the little what do they call it? The Prince's box or whatever. And now they do the you know, the Prince of Monaco and the Princess Charlene are up there. She almost got sprayed with, remember they sprayed with champagne last time? So Hamilton goes up to get his to see everyone. He shakes some hands, shakes the prince's hands, and then like he does like he gives her a handshake in that. What do we call that handshake? Where you're like that. You're
like, wait, did he dab the princess?
No. He like, you know, he, for some reason, like, I don't know, maybe they're all buddies. Maybe they went to school together or something, but you know, like the, your friend from school or something.
Wait,
or your brother.
Did he give her the predator handshake?
Like the not quite that one, but like, you know, hands in hands, like sort of shoulder to shoulder bump.
Really?
Like, yeah. Oh yeah. Straight up. Like,
oh,
yeah.
Hell yes.
I've got to find this.
So I watched it live and I was like, what the fuck? Because he only did it to her and no one else did it to anyone. So it just completely stood out because you're thinking like she's a princess and he basically just like greets her like you do. Your buddy,
homie.
Yeah, totally. So, like, I was amazing. I thought, like, I kind of liked this idea that maybe they just, you know, they're old friends, or they've just, she's just like, I won again. You know, hey, good to see
good
you.
To see you.
How are things? Yeah. So I had
oh
to.
Oh my God! It would kill me if he dapped up the princess. That would have.
Yeah.
So, Lewis Hamilton on top. Sebastian Vettel in second, followed by Valtteri Bottas. After Max Verstappen's 5-second penalty, he ends up fourth place, followed by his teammate Pierre Gasly, who also gets the fastest lap. Sainz in sixth, followed by Kvyat. Albon, double points for Toro Rosso.
Good job.
And then Ricciardo and Grosjean rounding out the top 10.
Great job by Albon all weekend.
Yeah. Norris is in 11th, followed by Perez, Hülkenberg, Magnussen, Russell in 15th place, which is a decent. And for Williams. Behind him, Stroll, Raikkonen, Kubica, and Antonio Giovinazzi. And then DNF is Charles Leclerc.
Such a shame for Kubica. He was actually having a decent drive. And, you know, it seemed like maybe a good circuit for them too. You know, it's not like people can get away from you that fast. So, big shame.
Yeah. Gasly up three places. Same with Sainz, who again had those amazing overtakes at the start. Perez also up four spots. Magnussen, terrible race. He lost 9 positions and was awarded a 5-second penalty for leaving the track and gaining an advantage. Ricciardo, even though he finished in the points, he lost 3 spots from his start. Grosjean, I think he earned 3 spots. And as previously mentioned, Russell. Up 4 to 15th place. So
Grosjean underqualified pretty badly as well, though. So
yeah, you're right. He did.
Poor guy.
In the championship, let's see. Driver wise, Hamilton on top with 137. 17 points back is Valtteri Bottas. And then Vettel retakes third place from Max Verstappen, who's in fourth. Leclerc's in fifth. Gasly's in sixth. Sainz jumps three spots with that finish to seventh place. And then we've got Raikkonen and Perez tied in eighth. Norris is 10th. And then we've got Magnussen tied with Kvyat, who also jumped up with the double points for Toro Rosso. Ricciardo's in 13th. Grosjean's tied with Albon, who also gained two places in the championship after this race. Hülkenberg slides four places. He's now in 16th place ahead of Stroll, which is the largest teammate points gap here. He's got four points and Perez has 13. Then we've got Antonio Giovinazzi, George Russell, and Bobby K, all with 0 points. Team-wise, Mercedes in a commanding lead once again with 257, 118 points ahead of Ferrari, who is 29 points ahead of Red Bull, who is 80 points ahead of McLaren. Then we've got Racing Point, Gene Haas and team tied with Toro Rosso. Renault's got 14 points in 8th place. 9th place is Alfa Romeo, and Williams with 0 points. I kind of thought Alfa Romeo got off to a strong start. Hopefully they can turn it around here. Although they're only 1 point away from Renault and 3 points away from Haas and Toro.
A lot of racing left.
There is. This is only race 6. Should we get to race 7, Danny? Or should we... actually, we got some news here.
Yeah, a little bit of minute news.
I've squandered that great, great segue. What do you got?
Max Verstappen, just on his aggression for the last stint of that race, or I guess the last stint, most of that race, really. This one from racefans.net. Verstappen penalty fired me up to attack Lewis Hamilton. Verstappen said, as soon as I heard about the penalty, I was just pushing Lewis really hard. Initially, he was driving so slow, and then I heard I had a penalty, so I kept pushing him. And then, of course, he had to push because otherwise I would attack him. And then he destroyed his tires, so that was my only way of trying to get by. Yeah, so basically saying, you know, wise head on his shoulders, pushing Hamilton, if nothing else, than to force Hamilton into the mistake of shredding his tires and maybe getting past him near the end. But obviously it didn't really happen. Verstappen wasn't able to pass Hamilton despite making contact with the Mercedes as he tried to claim the inside line at the chicane. The Red Bull driver said he didn't blame his rival for the collision. I couldn't really plan because I was always so close at the hairpin, but then all the time out of turn 8 we just lost momentum. At one point I said, okay, let's just have a go and see what happens. And then of course we had this little touch, but under braking you normally don't look in your mirrors already, and they are always difficult to see through, so I think there was no one to blame. Also, we didn't have any real damage. So all seems, you know, fair. That wouldn't be the conversation or interview that will be happening if he had taken Hamilton out, but
he's certainly not.
I guess both drivers respecting each other's intelligence in that situation. We have a mission winnow update if you're so inclined. Got a lot of emails about this and some others on our favorite energy drink, which will not come up in this part. I need like a month gap before we dive back into the the energy drink saga.
They're still rocking that logo though.
Good point. Yeah, they're gonna have to change the logo.
Oh wait,
are they? Oh wait a second.
Did I show you guys this?
Oh my god.
Yeah, someone wrote in and said, hey, I've got a rich energy here. Want me to send it to you? Well, wow. They did. And
there it is.
In my hand.
Is it just the one?
Just the one, yeah. So I don't want to open it because it's a collector's item.
We're doing the beer taste test next week, right?
I think so.
At E3, we're all going to be in LA.
Uh-huh.
I got cameramen. Let's make it happen. We'll do it. Ferrari are removing the Mission Winnow logo from its car for the next two rounds of the World Championship. The campaign run by tobacco publisher producer Philip Morris International was previously moved for the cars at the season opener in Australia. The team has now confirmed they will also disappear at the Canadian Grand Prix and the French Grand Prix. If anyone who's used to European sports knows that the French in particular are very panicky about tobacco and alcohol advertising as well. So we're going to not have those. No Mission Winnows for the next two races. Shout out to everyone who's on mission. Yeah, I have nothing else to say about that, really. The other note we have here, someone's thrown in, is the trailer for the Ford versus Ferrari movie, which we talked about, was it last week or 2 weeks ago? Have you guys watched the trailer?
Yeah, I did.
I watched it, yeah.
Yeah.
Looks I all think right. It was pretty good.
Looks like...
It looks violent. Like, really... Like, if you want to see, like, 1960s era, like, Le Mans class Ferraris just getting just shredded.
Like, Robin is racing?
Yeah, that looks like a scary freaking movie in some ways. I mean, it's such a great story. It's disappointing that the story is always primarily told from this American point of view. Right. Which I think is an issue with sourcing. I think the people most interested in telling the story tend to be Americans who are like, you know, what could be more American than Ford Motor Company taking on Ferrari?
And I guess Carroll Shelby being such a iconic person in sort of muscle car history, I guess, is it?
Yeah. I mean, it's just a legendary muscle car, but also like converting, like, you know, touring racing basically as well. Like he was a car modification and design genius, but it is a little bit, it's a story I think I would be curious to see more of the like Ferrari perspective on, given that to a degree this was also a fight that took years and there was an inevitability of outcome as Ford committed more and more resources to the program that Ferrari could never have matched in a million years.
Right.
And so there's kind of a, you know...
The trailer gives the opposite feeling, though, right? It gives right. the, like, rags to rich. We're up against those evil Europeans.
Americans love to feel like the underdogs, and certainly right. to begin with, the Ford program was the underdog. But by the end, it was an underdog front for a like one of the largest corporations in the world just crushing a boutique operation.
This is James Mangold, who directed Logan, Night and Day, Walk the Line, and a personal favorite of mine, 310 to Yuma, the 2007 remake of that good Western.
I didn't like that movie mostly because it wasn't enough like the original, but it's a movie I've thought about a lot.
Yeah, I've never seen the original or known anything about it actually.
Oh, the original's great. You should check it out. But it looks cool. Also, it's fun to see. I like seeing Christian Bale dig into like a character role as opposed to, because I think that's when he's done his best work. So I am kind of eager to see that. It looks cool as hell. Now I just need to hold out and light candles for the Enzo Ferrari biopic.
And who put in the Norris?
This one was me.
Do you want to take this one?
Yeah, I always think it's interesting when these guys talk about their simulator work. And as we've mentioned before, for Lando Norris and Max Verstappen, not only do a lot of sim racing in, I believe it's iRacing that they race in. They compete in an esports league, like on the same team. And Norris has some quotes here in a motorsport.com article just talking about, I guess, like the difference between F1 and the sim stuff. He says, "I'm not really racing Max on track here," meaning in F1. "So maybe later on this season or next year we can have some more battles. But I already learned about him when I raced Max and we had some fun races together." I guess he means virtually. "I can learn how he would drive on the track. I already learned how he would defend because he is very good at that. And he can be very aggressive at times with his overtakes and everything. Maybe you push a little bit more in the sim because you know you can get away with it. But there are a lot of things I take away from that, which I then learned about and knew about Max coming into this season." So there you go. Lando Norris has downloaded Max Verstappen. Confirmed.
I also have news.
Oh, yeah.
So just as we head into this next race in Canada, here's news you probably don't want to hear if you're a Ferrari fan. Binotto is saying, "For the time being, we haven't gotten any more changes coming on the car that will have a significant effect on the problems we've encountered since the start of the season." Now, sandbagging has a rich tradition in Formula One. I have no expectation that there's an incentive. If Ferrari were working on something that would like solve some of these problems, they probably wouldn't say, "Yeah, we've got a new package coming out that's going to fix why we've been getting our asses handed to us." Nevertheless, if that is on the level, that borders on an admission that from Ferrari's standpoint, 2019 is over. And
Yeah,
that's the thing, right? Like, they will probably be looking to the development of the 2020 program. That is my take on that. That things are in such a shambles right now that they're probably like they will continue to upgrade this car, but a mid-season overall suddenly feels less likely.
Well, yeah, speaking of Canada, you just want to get into it?
Sure. Circuit de Gilles Villeneuve on the St. Lawrence River, Ile de Notre Dame, named after Gilles Villeneuve, the Canadian Grand Prix driver who won the country's first Grand Prix. Is that right? It's built on a park island that's kind of half normal, kind of like Melbourne a little bit. Some of the roads are accessible during the year. The start finish straight obviously is not. Location of the 1967 World's Fair, which is not there anymore. Popular circuit for the drivers. They tend to really like it. Lots of challenging corners, relatively low downforce, very flat but tough on the brakes. There's a couple of very high speed sections on this with very sharp turns at the end of them. You get up to 250 kph on the one DRS straight. No, there's two. Sorry, there's one at the back underneath the bridge as well. Yeah, and I guess looking at it, it's a clockwise 14 corners, 4.36 kilometers. Turn one and turn two are super tricky, interesting turns. They are a lot of fun for the start of the race. In fact, I feel like the whole sector one of this track is bananas for the amount of traffic that goes through it. Turn one and turn two taking its sort of mid-gear range, really trying to stay hot on the accelerator while you're leading up into turn two, which is, this is where Alonso banked himself back in, God, I want to say 2005 now at this stage. I always think about that when I see the sort of undulating nature of some of these. It's a flat like circuit, but each turn seems to have its own little weird sort of angle going on and lots of interesting challenges with them. Turn five is super fast. They take it flat out during quali, but not so much during the race. The braking zone under the you brake underneath the bridge. That's one of the first really tough braking zones, and the next one is the hairpin in the sort of arena section, which is one of the best places to watch if you're a fan. There's loads of seating there, but they're basically absolutely flying down that section and then trying to brake. And it's kind of an overtaking spot, but the DRS detection line is there as well. And there's so much of a straight coming up next that oftentimes it's better just to get a better launch out of that chicane than try and overtake on it. Massively long DRS straight. The DRS zone is pretty early, and then you're down into a very fast left right with the wall of champions on the outside of it, the famous wall where many an F1 championship winner has dusted off part of or taken a chunk of that wall home with them. Somebody on Twitter recently sent me a video of qualifying from a number of years ago where Pastor Maldonado rounds that final turn and looks like he's about to smash into the wall of champions, but misses it and spins just in the middle of the road instead. Nothing more poetic for almost a champion. Never a champion. Always a spinner, Pastor Maldonado. This is also where Robert Kubica had his very, very nasty crash, which you often see in sort of horror reels when it comes to F1. Am I right in thinking it was after that season that he had his crash in rally? I think so. I may be wrong, but I think that was the last time he actually drove on the circuit.
I think that's right, and I don't think he. I think he. Walked away from
no
that?
He I,
no
I don't think so. I think he was out by the time the crash finished, so maybe he did eventually, but I thought they pulled him out of that one.
Oh wow.
Okay. It was a pretty bad one. Safety cars are pretty common here. We had one last year. Hartley and Stroll had a pretty nasty crash. You remember Stroll kind of lifted Hartley up into the wall?
Ooh, yeah.
The two of them were out of the race pretty early on in that one. This is, of course, as well, turn six is where Vettel had his spin on the final lap in 2005 to let Jenson Button win one of the longest and most entertaining races of recent memory. Canada's fun. I mean, curse of the commentator again. We say it can be fun. We said Monaco was going to be boring. Last year. Yeah, that's true. It had an interesting start, and then it all kind of nothing really much happened. Weather here, I'm interested to see what it's going to be like because it can play a factor here. Like I said, in 2000, I think it was 2005. I mean, no, 2011, wasn't it? Sorry, when we had the double red flag, I think it was because of rain. So
I think you're referring to the 2011.
Yeah, 2011. Sorry. Yeah, I think I said 2005 before.
Yeah. Well, I can enlighten you.
Yeah.
It looks like because Kubica's sort of the pre-accident phase of his career is so long ago that I think it tends to compress a little bit.
Right.
No, the really brutal Montreal accident happened in like 07.
Oh, okay.
And apparently he had the wreck in 2011. Right. The wreck that like damaged his arm.
Arm, right, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, but when was his last year in F1 though? Was this 2010? Oh, it was 2011? Okay.
Yeah. Well, no, sorry. So yeah, it would have been 2010 because it was the off season. Right. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so he has been back here, presumably, because it's been on the calendar for a good while now. Yeah, great little track. I know a lot of our listeners also go to this one up in the Great White North. So
one of my favorites.
Yeah, take some pictures, let us know. It's also great for North Americans because it's on at a decent time.
And Montreal, great town.
Never been.
Well, it's going to be beautiful if you are visiting for the Grand Prix because we've got 70 degrees-ish. For race day and qualifying, or if you're Celsius, around 20.
Which they surely are in Canada.
Certainly. No precipitation, however, until later in the evening on Saturday. Winds look to be about 5 or 6 miles an hour, 5 or 6 kilometers per hour. Just balmy. 43% humidity.
Beautiful. Yeah,
just fine. Tire-wise, we've got the C3, 4, and 5 for your hard, medium, and softs. And kind of all over the place as far as selections here. The Ferraris are taking 1 hard, 5 medium, and 7 softs. And then the Red Bulls are going 2, 4, 7. Mm. The McLaren and Racing Points are going 2, 2, and 9. So it's all over the place.
You have to take one of each. I forgot that.
Yes, you have to take at least one of each. And it must add up to 13 sets. We already went over the driver and team standings, but I will run down the fantasy league here. Alpha Emojis and Steering Wheel Hey Hey Give It To Me Move Come On are tied.
Whoa.
With 1,144 points apiece. Then in third place, we've got Maka F1, followed by the Hamiltons Break the System, Mercedes All the Way, Dragon Ball GT, Pointless Racing Force, Fry the Tires, Speed Beast, and Blow to the Future Part 3.
I think Pointless Racing Force is what Kimmy thinks the Force India are called now.
I am in place 681.
It's not been good. I've had Leclerc on the team for a while. Yep. It's not. Yeah. Mm.
I had, and I think I'll just roll right into Canada with this. Leclerc, Perez, Verstappen, Bottas, Turbo Raikkonen, and Racing Point. I might swap out Racing Point. They're
Turbo
not doing so
Raikkonen, bad. Kimmy's cousin. It's the Ralph Schumacher of the Raikkonen family.
You can join the Shift F1 League if you like by checking for our invite code in the show notes. Should we take it to some emails, Danny?
Sure. We've got a couple of them here we can squeeze in. It's been a long podcast, but it's been a lot of racing. So it's always good fun. This one in from Benjamin Kronkerberg, who says, there's something that has been bothering me about Ferrari's strategies this year. It seems to me that under new leadership, the Ferrari has been overly cautious across the board between how they handle the driver and racing strategies. It seems that this wait-and-see attitude has been costing them a lot of points, and qualifying at Monaco really helped solidify my opinion. Say what you will about Maruzio. Maurizio, I think that should be. But he seemed more confident with handling the team, even if they did make a mistake. I know it's been talked about before, but do you think Benito is too passive a leader when for what the team truly needs? This is obviously before the race actually happened. This email got sent in, so God knows what Benjamin thinks now. Yeah, I mean, we touched on it before, but is that the prevailing narrative still the case, do you think, Rob, that sometimes no decision is worse than a bad decision?
Yeah, I mean, I have more sympathy for it because, as you've pointed out, as I think we've all discussed, there's no way you can strategize your way around having an inferior car, and I think some of what has gone wrong is them trying to do that. But I do think it seems like right now, and maybe this is being unfairly ascribed to Binotto because he's the person where, you know, the buck stops with him. But there is something happening at that team that makes them passive and indecisive at crucial moments. And there are times when F1 unfolds at a pace where seconds count. And I do think there's something to be said for the fact that Binotto comes from a technical background. He comes from a background where you wait until you get a large enough sample size before you make a decision, because that is how you approach things as an engineer. But the problem is that F1 races are not experiments, and each one is kind of a best of one. You know, you have to make these calls, and you have to make them faster and better than they've been getting made.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see that. I feel like this question is going to be one we're constantly coming back to throughout the rest of the season. It's an interesting state of affairs. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I just I like the penalties question.
Oh, you want to do it? You want to take that one?
Yeah.
Okay, all
right,
cool.
Let's get this email from Adam Pfluger. Penalties. This is something that has been getting under my skin ever since I started watching F1 a few years ago. When are the stewards going to stop penalizing drivers by their name and start penalizing by offense? Every time the top six, and seeming more with Vettel and Verstappen, get a penalty, it seems to be two or more degrees less severe than the other drivers. My only real touchstone for penalties in sports is hockey, I'm Canadian after all, where each penalty clearly is clearly dictated by the rules. Cross-check someone? 2 minutes. Try to take someone's head off by cross-checking them? 4 minutes if they're bleeding and if it's obviously meant to harm someone. 5 minutes and you're ejected from the game. Each penalty is different, and the refs get things wrong plenty. Just look at this year's playoffs, but you know what you're getting, and it feels much fairer. It's honestly getting to the point where I'm considering turning the race off, though if you ask me by next week, I'll be eagerly awaiting the Montreal Grand Prix. I'm curious what you think of the premise here.
This is an interesting way to approach it because, like in football, you get this call equals this many yards. Same as he's saying here with Canada and the minutes. I think it would really help this sort of frustration, which I certainly feel as well, if the commentators or graphics or something, there was some kind of indication of like, here's what it might be, and here is what the rule is, and what is commonly associated with it in terms of penalties. Like, but there is really nothing. It's sort of just this black box of the stewards are looking at it, and then they have decreed that it's 5 seconds and not a drive through.
Yeah, it reminds
but maybe it
me
is
a
that
lot
ambiguous.
Of, it reminds me of a lot of like soccer, like. That a yellow card in the first 5 minutes needs to be pretty bad, but a yellow card in the 85th minute, you know, it's a little bit easier to get one then. And it's just part of the, like, I don't know, the like romantic nature of the sport who committed the crime and when it was somehow has some sort of bearing over it. And I think this is a situation I'd love to see some sort of like qualitative analysis of, like whether or not, you know, do people like Verstappen get more penalties or different penalties? Because like 5 seconds, for instance, for the release, that seemed pretty fair. I don't think they screwed him over on that one. I don't think it was his fault necessarily, but like it was 5 seconds. But it did feel like for a while there, Kvyat was getting crazy long numbers added onto the end of it. And was it being used as a slap on the wrist? Like, I don't know. I'd love for someone to actually put the time in to look at the numbers.
My feeling, so first of all, I actually think F1 is a lot more like hockey than Adam Scooby. Yeah, I think this premise that the rules are the rules, and the refs occasionally get things wrong, but they're sort of clear cut. I don't necessarily buy that. Like I live in Boston, so Bruins hockey is the hockey I watch, and it is clear to me that the Bruins operate with a degree of liberality from the refs to be sort of violent and thuggish on the ice that other teams, like playing other games, do not get. Like, the Bruins, like, pull moves that would routinely result in penalties or ejections in other conferences, in games played by other teams, but for whatever reason, the process is negotiated differently with the Bruins. I think this is most famous. Like, the Bruins beat the Vancouver Canucks back in, 2011, I want to say, in the finals. And the Canucks were this really, very fast-style hockey team that played a very graceful, elegant sort of game. And the Bruins were just, violent and vicious. And the Canucks, made a couple cheap hits. And after that, the refs were like, oh, you want to play the Bruins at their own game? That's cool. We'll just adjust our officiating style and we'll see what happens. And they got the shit knocked out of them. And I think that happens all the time in hockey. And I think what it comes down to is reputations, whether this is intentional or not, reputation and expectation affects how referees and judges hand out penalties. Hmm. I think Max Verstappen did get really lenient treatment in his early years in F1 because he was Max. He was Yost's son, who guy seems like a grade A asshole, but seems to have friends and influence up and down the pit lane. So I've always kind of felt that for whatever reason, there are drivers that people take a line against and there are drivers that people decide to indulge. Schumacher, there were a lot of cases where people said that guy needed to be slapped down. He was in the gray way too often, and he was let off the hook.
Yeah, the one thing I'd add as well is that Formula One, unlike a lot of sports, the rules are constantly changing. Like, the cars are changing. There's new rules, but there's old rules being taken away a lot of the time. So it just kind of feels like a bit more of a malleable soup. So just even taking the personalities out of the equation, I feel like the penalties and everything are always changing as well. And the expectations of what the drivers can and can't do in their own heads is kind of maybe out of step a little bit with that every once in a while.
I think also because they're in a car, it can be more difficult to establish intent.
Yeah, that's true.
Maybe that's why you do get the sense that stewards are looking at historical actions.
Right.
You know what? Hockey used to do that was really good. I don't know if they do it as much, but they would have videos posted where the head of officiating explained the reasoning and would literally pull game tape from going back years on players. Like, hey, here's why we suspended this guy. Here's a move he did in 2006 that was borderline. Here's a similar penalty in 2008. And so it would explain here's why this guy got suspended for 5 games and this guy did something similar and was ejected, but was otherwise went without repercussion. And that is a really good way. I would love to see that F1 embrace some of that new media type stuff, where how cool would it be if you had one of the racing, like one of the guest stewards or something putting out a video of okay, so here's how we assess the Verstappen incident in the pits.
Yeah. They never
Twitch stream it.
Yeah, they never cut to, which they do all the time in American sports, they cut to a former referee and say, what do you think of this?
Yeah.
They never do that in Formula One.
Yeah, there's just two things that came up. I'm not sure where to stick this in. Maybe this is the right place to do it. But two things that crossed my mind earlier that I forgot about. One, speaking about the rules and breaking them, Schumacher intentionally crashing at Raskas in qualifying. I totally had forgotten about this. Somebody sent it to me on Twitter, I think, a couple of days before the race started, where he famously you're talking about intent, he got some understeer and went into a wall and yellow flagged, and I guess the end of qualifying, and ended up being in.
Oh, weird!
First
I got pole position.
Result. Huh. Yeah, totally. And then the other thing is, did you see the issue of Perez almost hitting the two marshals?
I didn't see that. No,
he came out of when they were trying to clear some of the debris. He came out of the pit lane, and the marshals, kind of like in Canada that time, one of them ran past like towards the wall, and the other one literally stopped and like did that, like stretched out and like stopped himself from falling forward, and Perez drove between the two of them.
Oh boy.
Yeah, and he came over the radio and said, oh my god, I almost killed that guy. I think it was, I don't know, was it during qualifying? I don't think it was the race. But it's harrowing. There's a couple of videos. There's one taken from one of the apartments above him where it's so close.
It's such a dangerous, this is such a dangerous track to service. Like I was, during the safety car, you'd see guys running out there in the blind part of the corner with the brooms, and then one guy standing out there in the middle of the track, basically just trying to eyeball what's coming. And it's just wild to me the degree to which the marshals are exposed at this track. This thing, Monaco is a legacy. You know, we're never going to get rid of it. There is no way this race would be greenlit in 2019.
Yeah, totally. That's why we love it. And another email here from Fayez Imam, who says, are you aware of the concept of Formula 1.5? This is for Drew, our resident statistician. I thought you'd enjoy this one, mate. Hey, guys, saw this going around in recent weeks, and I love the idea. It's even spawned its own community on Reddit. Basically, it's about looking at the F1 season as if Mercedes, Ferrari, and Red Bull don't exist, and most importantly, reflowing the points to everyone else. Looking at the new standings, I have to say it's dramatically more interesting than the real one, and I have to say this as someone rooted for Hamilton's clean sweep. What do you guys think of following this idea over the rest of the season, since it looks very possible that the standings and points are now basically set in stone at the top? Drew, I feel like you've brought this up before in previous seasons, right?
Yeah, it's been going for a while.
Have you been checking in on it this year?
No, I don't. It simultaneously feels a little cynical, but also right. as also a way to have more fun with it. So I don't know. I think it's an interesting idea. They do. It looks like they, looking at their website, F1.5 spelled out point in the number five. Well, I'll link to that as well.
My favorite thing about it is that everything, all the graphics for this are like 100% sincere. They stole them, but they've like replicated the F1 website. The F1 logo is like the same. And if you look at like the Reddit banner, it's just like Nico Hülkenberg, Carlos Sainz, Ricardo, Perez, and Raikkonen, like standing like, you know, like it's always Hamilton in the front and then whoever's behind it, it's like the five of them. It's just, it's great. I love it. It's like an alternate reality.
I think the thing I really do like about it, like looking over this, is imagine how it recasts, though, your appreciation for the different drivers out there, right? And, like, what they are able to accomplish. Like, right now, it is very difficult for me to speak knowledgeably about, like, how good Lando Norris seems. Because when I notice him, it's because he's kicking ass. And so I'm like, damn, like, Lando Norris seems like such a promising, brilliant driver. And then I'm always surprised at the end of the race where I'm like, he did not finish as strong as I would have expected. And I'm never quite certain how, because I've been basically following the action at the front for the most part, right? And like, maybe for the podcast I'll investigate that, but I think it is an interesting thought experiment if you sort of cut off the front runners and just look at who else is out there. I don't know that it's kind of a goofy concept. I'll tell you this, if I were thinking about like replacing one of my drivers for next year at one of the top teams, I would probably be looking at F1 this exact way.
One of my favorite things is that they go back and they've like retroactively done every championship. So if you go back to 1950, the first winner of Formula 1.5 is Prince Bira, who is, what was his name? Bira Bonj Banujed, I want to say. Banujed.
Is he the Thai guy?
Yes, he's the member of the Thai royal family who won. So I didn't realize where he had come, but he came eighth, apparently, in 1950, only completing two races. He came fifth in Monaco and fourth in Sweden. He retired from two of the other ones, and he didn't turn up to the other three, as was the tradition at the time. But he still managed to win the Formula 1.5.
So what? So who did they erase from history there?
According to the rest of the winners, Giuseppe Farina, Manuel Fangio came second, Luigi Fagnoli, Luis Rosier.
But by what criteria are they eliminating the other people? Because Red Bull didn't exist. Is it Ferrari and Mercedes?
It must be Ferrari. Who? It must be just like the top.
So in the top of their Reddit, they explain their logic. Any team scoring podium finishes at less than 25% of World Championship Grands Prix is considered eligible for the 1.5 championships. I assume that means within a season, right?
Okay.
Like, so they're taking the cream this is intense. Off the top.
Yeah, no, this is okay. This is a fascinating.
And they do reissue the points, so it's and with the current FIA point system, so it's not just so Perez currently in Formula 1 currently has 13 points, but in Formula 1.5 he's got 69. And Magnussen has 68, Sainz with 65, tied with Albon. So they reissue the points based on quote the finish.
This is
tremendous.
There's an entire article explaining how the 1951 went down with like data and flowcharts.
Oh, and they have,
amazing.
The driver with the most world championships, Jenson Button with 5. He won in 2002, 3, 5, 6, and 13.
But this is the thing. Like, there were always people, like, there were people for ages saying Jenson Button was a radically underrated driver, and he just hadn't ever been put in a winning car until that one, like, magical year with Braun. Outside of that, he never had a fair shot. And so if you looked at F1 all those years, it became increasingly hard for me to understand why he had this good reputation, because like it never materialized on the track. But through the statistical magic of Formula 1.5, now we can like adjust. It's basically like, what a cool thing. If you've ever looked at F1 and thought, damn, I wish this had like promotion and relegation.
Yeah,
the F1.5 crew is on the case.
Well, best of luck to current champion Nico Hülkenberg throughout the rest of this season.
It's really interesting running through the subreddit here and seeing just all the news posts and what it's like when you eliminate the top three. It's just such a different news landscape.
There's 18,000 members on this subreddit, and they are committed to the bit. Like this is this is wonderful work. Congratulations to everyone involved.
It reminds me, did you guys ever remember, I think it was in high school or no, I think it was in middle school. There was this website devoted to spreading the word against dihydrogen monoxide.
Okay.
Like dihydrogen monoxide found in cancerous tumors. Dihydrogen monoxide, a key component in acid rain.
Amazing.
That's good.
Yeah.
Nice.
So, yeah, we'll link that in the show notes. That's pretty good.
This is everybody doing power rankings on, like, you know, sports and TV shows. No, this is that's for children.
Yeah, this is way more fun.
You can also, for fun stuff, follow us at ShiftF1 Podcast on Twitter. I'm at Drew Scanlon. Danny O'Dwyer.
At Danny O'Dwyer.
Rob Zagney.
At Rob Zagney.
That's us around the internet. Do you want to take us around the world of racing, Danny?
I think I would really appreciate it if we took a little trip and raced around the world.
Gander Mountain Trucks are at the Texas Motor Speedway for the Rattlesnake 400. Doesn't get much better, folks.
Stone Cold Steve Austin, baby. Let's go.
The W Series is racing in Misano in Italy with DTM at the Misano Oval Circuit. Marco Simoncelli. I also think I saw a... apologies for not looking into this more, but I saw a livery for a DTM car for Andrea Dovizioso, who is currently a MotoGP rider. So he might be driving a DTM car this weekend. IndyCar is at the Texas Motor Speedway for the Texas Indy 600. World Superbike is at the Circuito de Jerez. MXGP is at, Krasnodar Krai in Russia. Didn't know MX went there. The NHRA is at the Heartland Motorsports Park for the Maynard's Heartland Nationals.
Formula 1.5 is at Montreal this weekend.
Should I do that? I forget if I'm doing the NASCAR voice for the Xfinity series too.
The people want it. I don't think, you know, the sanctity is, they're not going to care.
Okay. Well, then we got two NASCARs coming up for you. We got the Xfinity series. It's NASCAR Junior.
Oh boy.
Both of them are at the Michigan International Speedway. Xfinity series. They're doing the LTI printing 250.
2019. Good year for printing.
Yep. And then regular old NASCAR, the Monsters. They're doing the Fire Keepers Casino 400.
Wow.
Hope you're feeling lucky. Same place, Michigan International Speedway.
And then we got F1. Practice 1 kicks off at 10 a.m. Eastern Time, Friday, June 7th on ESPNU, followed by Practice 2 at 2 p.m. Practice 3 Saturday, June 8th at 11 a.m. on ESPN2, followed by qualifying at 2 p.m. on ESPN News. But then the race, everyone, Sunday, June 9th, kicks off at 1:30 p.m. on regular old ABC.
1:30?
Terrestrial television. Yeah, that might mean that I think the race is at 2 p.m. actually, but coverage starts at 1 p.m. So get it over the air.
Yeah, very reasonable. Go watch if you haven't.
Very reasonable.
If you're one of the... There is always a contingent who listen to this podcast who have never watched a race. So go check it out this time.
Yeah, it's on a normal hour and a free channel.
Exactly.
If you'd like to support the show, you can do so at patreon.com/shiftf1. Get access to all our bonus episodes and videos and stuff.
Yeah, F1 Race Stars. We just put up the F1 game history for F1 Race Stars. The Mario Kart meets the 2011 Formula One Series video game. It's a lot of fun. I forgot how awesome that game is. That game is a lot of fun.
I think there is a Giant Bomb quick look of that I am on. Before I knew anything about Formula One. So I think somebody, maybe it's Jeff or Vinny, they asked me, so are these real F1 people? And it's like, you know, Sebastian Vettel right in front of me. And I go, I don't know.
Yeah.
So have you ever played this one?
Pardon?
Do you ever play it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. That's good stuff. So that's still up on Giant Bomb, is it? You're sticking the show notes.
I think so. Yeah, I'll put that in there.
It's so good. Yeah, they like took real tracks and then sort of took the essence of the place and kind of put them together. Like the Abu Dhabi tracks got Ferrari World in it, and it's like, I don't know. I think if nothing else, the track design in that game was very well done. Yeah, it's a good bit of fun. So if you're a patron, go check out that video.
Cool. Well, I'm looking forward to another race in sunny Canada. So
sure, yeah.
Nothing sunnier than Montreal in June. I remember that time Button drove from the back to the front in the rain. God damn, that was a great race.
2011, so good.
Yeah, there's an Alt F1 episode about that.
Yeah, we went back and just did a recap of that whole race. It was so good.
Well, hopefully the same thing happens again this time. Have a good
Robert
race weekend,
Kubica,
everyone.
Congratulations.
We'll see you all next week.
Yeah.